Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lay at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I'm good. I think actually it is a convergence that lies, not lay. So let me just correct my own grammar there.
Okay. I was going to let it slide. I wasn't going to jump all over that, I promise.
Well, I think I would have heard about it later. That's what my theory is, I would have heard about it later. So I wanted to, you know, before we bring Michael out, make sure I've cleaned up my grammar because that's, you know, that's what I'm all about here. So how are you?
Excellent. Everything's going pretty good. We have had a fantastic series. I mean, we've never tried anything quite this ambitious before with Fast Forward Radio, and here we are at the end of, well, 11 weeks now. It was a 10-part series over an 11-week period, and just outstanding, really, really fun series to do.
I think it says a lot that we're in the 11th week of our 10-week series. That tells you quite a bit right there.
We had more than we could squeeze in.
We had more than we could possibly fit. And here's the wacky thing is, the really big stuff comes tonight. I mean, not to say that we haven't hit big stuff, because clearly we've talked about, how people can extend their lives. We've talked about how poverty can be eliminated. We've talked about whether the universe is some kind of computer simulation. So I mean, we've hit on big issues before, but I don't think anything, and with Ray Kurzweil talking about the technological singularity, but I don't think anything can quite prepare for the last half hour of our interview with John Smart. We actually have the full last hour in which we'll talk about human destiny. Last week we talked about convergence and acceleration, these two forces that are driving this amazing period of transformation that we're in. And tonight's the payoff. Tonight we're going to talk about where it all leads, and we'll spend about half an hour with John talking about what it means to become a sexy, immortal billionaire with superpowers. And then we're going to talk about what happens after that. And what's remarkable is how much ground we'll cover, actually. I was thinking about this. Remember that one of the questions that I asked Ray Kurzweil had to do with this statement that different people had made, including himself, about how in a century – humanity will experience, and depending on who you listen to, Stephen Hawking or Ray Kurzweil, or there was someone else, humanity experiences either 10,000 or 20,000 or 35,000 years of change over that one century. Okay, so
right.
Tonight I think we're going to probably get to somewhere in the vicinity of 100 million years worth of change for humanity that we'll cover in the final 30 minutes of that interview.
That's right. We're not even aiming for the singularity anymore. We're beyond that. So.
Actually, yeah, we're going to start with one singularity, and then John actually takes us to yet another singularity. So, in case one's not enough for you, so we'll go to like the singularity beyond the singularity, and I think if he'd had another hour, he'd take us to another one after that. But it was great having the chance to talk with him and to get this interview put together. Well, I should introduce our chat host, Michael Darling, who is also with us.
Good evening.
How are you?
I'm, perfectly, practically indifferent.
Okay. Well, I hope we can move beyond indifferent as we get into this.
I'm not apathetic. I'm passionate.
Okay.
I'm just, sated in every possible way.
All right. Okay. Well, wait till you hear. Wait till we hear what we've got for you this evening. So, Michael will be manning our chat room, staffing our chat room, I should say, the non-sexist term here, taking your comments, and we will be talking after we've played the entirety of the second half of the interview. So we'll play all of the rest of the interview, which was pre-recorded a week before last, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about what we've heard. So without further ado, I'm going to say, here's our part two of our interview with John Smart.
Let's talk about where humanity goes next. Our next topic is human destiny. And, you know, when you try to even begin to talk about the future of humanity, you've got a daunting task on your hands, whether you talk about it from a sociological standpoint, a technological standpoint, a biological standpoint. As a futurist, I've developed a lot of my thinking around the human imperative and some of these other concepts that we talk about at the speculus, the optimum configuration of the universe and ideas like that, as a means of just creating a sort of a rhetorical framework that would at least make it possible to start thinking about human destiny and asking questions about it in a coherent way. But, and that's as a futurist. But as a marketing guy, which is my day job, I came up with a much simpler formulation. And when people ask me about the future of humanity, I tell them, well, where we're headed is we're going to be sexy, immortal billionaires with superpowers. And I think what that lacks in precision and discipline, it seems to make up for in getting some ideas across. Now, do you think that's a fair assessment? I think I know where you are already on the immortal part, but if not the fate of humanity, at least where we'll be in a century or so.
Well, it is a excellent rhetorical device for getting people engaged with these ideas. And we need all those kinds of things to simplify them, to make them attractive and interesting. And there's definitely, I think you can take every single one of those things you said and show great scenarios for how those things could happen. The sexiness, obviously, certainly a big issue that Ray is interested in. He's very much interested in that kind of the future of the senses in virtual reality and things like that. And he said some interesting things about that in his books. And I think that the immortal part is also completely obvious if you talk about this evo-devo perspective of immortality. So, for example, in a biological system, the immortality of that intelligence is partitioned into three places: the seed, the organism, and the environment. So you and I are pretty amazingly resilient as a tripartitioned intelligence structure, because over multiple previous cyclings, our developmental genes have tuned up to take all this interesting information about this relatively stable environment that we grew up in, and they're going to take that and they're going to put it into our kids. And we're going to create copies of our kids that have genetic and cultural imprints that are very, very similar to what we had, but they're also going to be different in interesting new ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a whole lot of intelligence, of our intelligence, stamped into living in all three of those locations. And so if the organism has to die, that is a very narrow way to think about mortality, because the seed doesn't die and the environment doesn't die. And so if you talk about your sexy cybernetic Phil in 2050, well, I can tell you it's very clear that there's going to be neural nets you're going to have in your brain that are going to compete with each other, and they're going to be dying all the time. When if some guy grows up as a kid kicking dogs, and then as an adult they recognize dog kicking is wrong, what do you think happens to all those neural networks, all the synaptic weightings of those finely tuned nets that used to reward dog kicking?
Right,
they
those
die.
Have to go. Yeah.
They die. So death. So seeds, replication of the seeds, development of the adult, in this case a functional neural network. And then a metastable environment in which that network operates and from which it pulls most of its information, although it creates some new information, of course, as well. It shuffles it around and imagines and thinks. But all three of those are fundamental to any complex system, and two of them are immortal. So, yes, you're still going to be immortal. But more interesting thing is you'll probably understand your immortal versus your more changing aspects of yourself much better than you would today. So if you need to give them the immortality pill or phrase as the first step, and then later on you help them understand, hey, it's actually only two-thirds, buddy. The other third really is constantly cycling. Well, that's fine, because they're eventually going to figure that out. And themselves anyway. And billionaires, that is also completely obvious, isn't it? The wealth that we're moving into is staggering. And people who think that this drop that we've seen recently is, you know, somehow a portend for some terrible instability in the system, well, they just don't understand technical productivity. Because GDP is not the game here. The game is technical productivity. Remember we talked about those TPMs, those technology productivity metrics?
Right.
Well, technical productivity is a general term for why GDP grows, period. Why does it grow every year? A guy named Bob Solow got a Nobel Prize in 1984 for saying 7/8 of GDP growth is due to technical productivity. And that's the intelligence and efficiency of all the technologies that we use. We are like these bees or termites just polishing this beehive or this termite mound. And this termite mound, we take a little bit of it into our brains, we polish it, and we put it back out into the technology space. And that a termite mound or that beehive just gets better and better and better every year. And that's the wealth that's really underlying all of the economy. All of this money, it's just a proxy. GDP is just a proxy for TP. All the political games we play with the money, trying to decide who gets more, who gets less, that's all human political games played on top of this accelerating boat of increasing technical productivity. And the better we understand that, the better our policy can be, like Obama with his recent decision to spend a significant amount of U.S. GDP on science and engineering in the United States. That's exactly the kind of insight you need to have to recognize that's really what's going to happen. And if Wall Street has to shrink by, you know, a quarter or a third, like some people have said, because this great export we used to do, finance, you know, people aren't going to trust us with it the way they did for at least the next generation. Well, then one of the biggest benefits of that is all these physics and math PhDs that got sucked out of our top universities into the quant roles in Wall Street. Well, those guys are going to be able to go back and do something that's more useful, because that was useful to the powers that be to try and figure out better money capturing technologies. But it wasn't adding to technical productivity. Maybe it was adding a little bit to the artificial intelligence of the algorithms, but mostly it wasn't adding to TP. And if they don't recognize that, then they're just going to get their lunch taken away from them by countries like China and India that are much more focused on TP. You know, thank goodness that we have a truly pluralistic political structure on the, you know, in the world. We have places that are going to be governing the system to make sure that acceleration continues, even though a lot of people are going to turn away from that. You know, the leadership vacuum you were referring to earlier.
Wow. How about superpowers? You left out superpowers.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's a beautiful time. I mean, one of the really neat things that I've seen in the media, X-Men and these other movies, is that all the comics are being done as movies because people are recognizing, hey, man, there's some truth here. There is some grain of truth here, is that we're going to a world where we're going to have tremendously more capabilities than we have today. Now, I think it's very important to say that that's nothing like God, right? A superpower is nothing like God. It's still a very finite system. It's still a system, as Ray, I believe, would say, that has a whole bunch of stuff it doesn't understand about the universe.
Right, and I always make that distinction on both the immortal and the superpowers.
So you could say that, you know, some creature that has the ability to kind of sense all over the planet, maybe it's got a portion, you've got a portion of yourself that's actually conducting experiments on the moon, another portion that's walking down Olympus Mons on Mars and doing some sightseeing, and all that stuff is being wired to you, obviously an 8-minute delay from Mars, but, you know, 1.5 seconds from the moon. It's all being wired to you, and you're all experiencing it as if you're transliving in all those locations. That's a pretty cool kind of a concept of your hyper-consciousness, to use Wallace's term, right? We are going to have something beyond what we call normal consciousness, and we need a term for it, and hyper-consciousness is a good word as any. But at the same time, that thing is completely still finite. You're still very curious what's going on in all these other Earth-like or intelligent environments around the universe. You'd love to meet up with those folks if you can. You'd be looking for them. You're trying to figure out still some of the basic laws of the universe you're not going to fully understand. And also, most importantly, the future is still going to be a combinatorial explosion of unknowns for you. So you're still going to have free will. You're still going to have moral quandaries and all kinds of things you don't understand. And so you're not godlike. You're not omniscient. You're not omnipotent. And you don't have the ability to create new universes. But you sure have superpowers. You sure have a whole lot more than what, you know, your ancestors had. And so you've really got a far more interesting and compelling world. And I would say it's like a gravitational attractor that's like a black hole that's pulling you toward it because it's just so statistically better kind of a future. And I think it's valuable for us to state things that way. And it's a little bit for a lot of scientific relativists, and there are a good number of them who say that, you know, they're really, science can't say anything about values or progress. These are kind of fighting words to say that there's anything that's predictable. But I believe we have to say that. So for me, the key phrase that we have to get to before human destiny, which is itself a red flag word, the word destiny, right, to a scientist, is the word progress. Now, is there progress going on in human history? And if so, how would we measure it? How do we define it? Because now we have to bring in a whole set of values. Now, there's a bunch of scientists, philosophers of science called the instrumentalists and others who say, there isn't any progress. You can't define it. I mean, it's kind of a random accident that we're seeing increasing complexity over time. Well, those people, I don't think, bring anything to the table other than their critique of the other models. And they say, look, you know, these other models need to be better validated. Sure they do. But I think if you want to believe everything is random, then you're going to live in a world, you're going to innovate in a world, you're going to make decisions in a world that reflect that set of values. And I believe you're going to be less successful than people who see the tsunamis of change that are coming and they get out their surfboards and they ride them because they say, these are inevitable statistically. They might not happen, you know, a global pandemic or a nuclear strike, a meteorite could slow it down, but it's eventually going to come. I'm going to get ready for it now. And the scientific relativists would say there's no progress, or the fundamentalist religious evangelicals who say, yes, there's progress, but it's in this special place you can't test, an afterlife. And all you got to do is believe in it, and you'll get there. And by the way, you can't get a lot of progress here, because if you could, that would violate my core belief that all the progress happens in the afterlife. I believe both of those ways of thinking are far less productive, and they're going to get adaptively outcompeted by the people who see the progress, even though we can't really measure it that well. But what we can get is a whole bunch of people to get around a table and say, yeah, well, we have all these different definitions of what an emergent complex system is, but you know what? I see the acceleration pattern in all of them, no matter what definition I use. The closer I get to the present time, the faster things go. And that's really interesting because it suggests there's something driving that that's beyond our individual human agency.
Well, and I think that when you talk about progress, it's interesting that it is easier to gauge relatively if you put a little space between yourself and a target. For example, when I do the opposite question, you know, we're going to be sexy immortal billionaires, whatever. You know, what are we now? Get your time machine, pull a peasant from the year 1000, and you know, drop him into this world and let him observe us. See what we're up to, you know, see how we live. What are we to that individual?
So well done, yeah.
Yeah, we're like wizard kings, right? I mean, we're...
Isn't that what history gives us? It gives us such incredible insight. The further out we take our scope, the more insight we get into how the whole system works and what our responsibilities are, not just to see the things that are unpredictable, but the things that have this uncannily smooth predictability to them, which is this increase in progress. And you know what's so interesting is there's a beautiful book called The History of Progress by J.D. Burry. It was written, I believe, in 1939, I think, towards the end of the Depression. And he basically said that the average person couldn't believe in the concept of social progress until the Enlightenment, until the 1600s to 1800s. And that's because, you know, let's go to Roman times, right? You think, oh my God, so much progress. I mean, all these amazing aqueducts and all this advance in civilization. But, you know, the average pay of the Roman soldier was something like 50 denarii for like 200, 300 years. So they basically saw cyclical change is what they saw. They saw things rise and fall. And then, of course, after Rome falls and city sizes shrink and all the aqueducts crumble, you know, everybody can just say, of course, everything's cyclical. It's like the seasons. It's like the weather. It's like peaks and there's valleys, but there's no progress. It's only when the Enlightenment occurs that you get the state switch. And now everybody, the average person, believes in progress. And the other really interesting, but they believe in it only intuitively. Let's be very clear about that. I mean, there were a bunch of people who had this very functionalist definition that the world was kind of clockwork and that we'd be able to predict everything about it. And those folks got a big backlash because, of course, the world doesn't work like that, you know, the Laplacian kind of determinism. There's only a small statistical determinism to a very small subset of things, these developmental things. And that's only probabilistic determinism. And everything else is contingently, creatively stochastic or chaotic, as the chaos theorists like to say. So you really have to be careful in trying to define what progress is. But yet, when we look at it from across the room, like you said, we go back to these early days, and we're the wizard kings today, and you see it. And now, since the Enlightenment, the average person believes that it's there, and that's really the scientific methodology in a nutshell, is yes, we can make serious, measurable progress in our understanding of the world system and our ability to manipulate it by following this methodology. And as Burry said, the great success of the religions was 1,000 years earlier, which is when all the religions were created, right?
Mm-hmm.
Before the Enlightenment. Those were their codes were last edited. They weren't edited since then, no major ones anyway. They got people to believe in progress, which they felt was there. They intuitively felt it was there, according to Burry. You know, they see their kids learning more than they did.
Right.
They got them to believe in it by basically saying, yes, it happens, but it happens in a space that you can't test. And all you got to do is this, that, and the other, and now you'll get it, but you'll get it later. And that is a very compelling, very useful heuristic and way of thinking for that time. But I don't think it's the way of thinking for the time that we're in today. I think today we need to have what's called scientific naturalism, right? This idea that the universe is the thing that we need to understand. And the word God is probably redundant or coextensive with universe. And so we have to say, what is the universe? Why are we here? How do we understand it better? This is Spinoza's idea that you understand the deepest things, the most important things, by studying the whole system. And then, from that, I think we get some purposes. We recognize that our evolutionary purpose is to create, our developmental purpose is to complete this hierarchy and safely replicate the system. And I would call those two purposes innovation on the evolutionary side and sustainability on the developmental side. And it's curious that those two purposes are pretty much the two major activist dialogues that we find in politics, right? We've got kind of this very democratic protection, sustainability on the social side, but they're all innovation on the cultural side. And the Republicans are all innovation on the financial side and sustainability on the social side.
Right.
And so you see, so this innovation and sustainability, they're the deepest dialogues. I think we have a whole lot of people who really want to preserve the complexity of the planet, stop us from overfishing the oceans and all the terrible things we're doing to it. And then we've got a whole bunch of other people who want to innovate our way out of these problems. And they're both right. I think they're both fundamentally right, because those are the two deepest dialogues, sustainability and innovation. And we need a sustainably innovative society. The sustainability people who say you're going to keep everything the same, those guys become irrelevant quickly because we're constantly innovating. And the innovation guys who ignore sustainability, they become caricatures and they're seen as extremists very quickly because they're ignoring the sustainability side.
I think you have to have both. Well, now, what's going to happen after this sexy immortal stage? Can we say anything about a post-biological self-aware system that eventually comes concurrent with or after humanity, however that rolls out? Can we even speculate as to what those systems will be like? And what will we be, original humanity, original substrate humanity, what will we be to them?
Right. I think we can. I'm gonna try and let me paint two scenarios for you. And these are speculations, best semi-educated hypotheses that we're trying to test, right? And most importantly, we've only just started asking these questions from a species standpoint. So we really need to ask them a lot more. We need to have journals. We need to have masters and PhDs in acceleration studies. They don't exist, right? Or singularity studies, if we use Ray's term, right? We don't have them. And once we do, our convergence studies, right? I mean, we do have some masters now in emerging technologies, which is wonderful. And there's 15 places you can get a Foresight PhD or master's. And I got one of them a couple years ago at University of Houston, one of the 15. But 15 is pretty small. science and technology studies didn't even exist significantly in the universities until about the 80s. So it has only recently emerged on the scene. But the STS people, many of them don't do long-term foresight. They don't do the 30-year stuff that we're talking about right here or beyond. So where do we get better speculations? We have to treat it seriously, and that's why I started the Acceleration Studies Foundation in 2003. Within the next 20 years, I'm hoping we're going to get a master's or a PhD. And if you come, you know, to our EvoDev Universe conference, you'll find other academics who are interested in looking at things from an evolutionary and developmental standpoint. So on to the speculations. Okay, so the two that I'd like to paint first are, what are you going to be like? What might you be like in a quasi-singularity, post-singularity world? Singularity, again, being generally human surpassing artificial intelligence, which is probably going to happen statistically across the entire planet. It's going to take a whole planet to educate a smart Google. It's not going to be any one person or team that's going to make this, and it's going to be pretty incremental if it happens in an evolutionary fashion. And I can give you some evidence for previous evolutionary developmental transitions that, again, required that very, very broad base of evolutionary experimentation before the developmental punctuation occurs. So here you are. It's 2020, let's say, and you've got a cyberfill, and you've been using this conversational interface on Google and the other folks for a good 10 years now, and it's starting to collect some of your values, and many of the things that you care about are private data that you don't want to share with others, so marketers and others would manipulate it if you did. And or maybe they actually got it first in a dystopian world, and you had to claim it back later, which is quite possible, right? Because the plutocrats are incredibly powerful right now, and we need to swing back to a more democratic world. It's going to take some time. But as long as they can't take away the vote, right, as Tony, I forget his name, but a beautiful activist in Britain who says, you know, as long as they can't take away the vote, we're going to get democracy back. It's going to take some time before people get educated enough to use it more intelligently. And, of course, more importantly, to use the voting they do with the things they buy more intelligently. So here you are, 2020. Now you've got a cyberfill, and it's got some private data that you don't share with others about your values, and it's got a bunch of other public data that you have pushed to the web about what your values are so that you can find other people who have similar values to you and do cool things with them, right? And you are reaching for a can of tuna, and your cyberfill whispers in your ear, you don't want that one, you want the one, you know, 2 inches to the left. And you want the one 2 inches to the left because they're not killing the dolphins anymore or poisoning the oceans or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you can flash on the reason why if you want, but most people will just move their hand to the left. And they'll probably set up these automated proxies where they'll send off a flip the bird message email to the guys that are still killing the dolphins or poisoning the oceans or whatever when they move their hand those 2 inches. And there's beautiful studies that show that large, powerful corporations and governments will change their behaviors if they have reliable data that says 5% of their market was lost on a particular purchasing decision or a particular sector because they did XYZ thing, which is something that they can change. If they can clearly see that data, then they change. And that's the only thing powerful enough. That is the only thing powerful enough to rein in a multinational corporation or a government is a value cosm attached to your cyber twin, which looks after your values. And, you know, you're driving down the street, and, you know, any one of the nameless fossil fuel filler uppers you could go to get your gas, and your GPS system's plugged into your value cosm, and it sends you to the one that most reflects your values, and ExxonMobil discovers you're not going to buy their crap until they do your favorite NGO's XYZ thing. Dow Corporation bought Union Carbide, and they haven't cleaned up Bhopal yet, right? All the environmental and the health disaster that was created after that. Well, you can boycott every Dow chemical thing until they clean up that friggin' worst technological disaster of the 20th century. And you can do that because your cyber twin takes care of all of that. You don't have to figure out what products in your supermarket are in Dow chemicals. There's no way they're going to let you figure that out. In fact, they play a game with you called category saturation where, you know, the Procter & Gamble is going to make 9 different varieties of the same stupid dishwashing soap just so that, and it's legal for them to do that in the current politics, because just so that any new guy who wants to come in is just going to be one little guy of 13 rather than one out of 2. And so they play all these really interesting games to make sure that the choice, there really isn't any choice there. There really isn't any innovation. And as Clayton Christensen says in The Innovator's Dilemma, beautiful book, big companies are not innovative. Big companies' jobs are to do what he calls innovate and wait. They want to get to the future first, sit on it, patent it, and then sell you their old crap for as long as they can because it makes the most money for them and the shareholders until they are forced to create the new thing because some mid-sized company or smaller starts gaining market share. So the only, if you're one of the 20% that cares about sustainability, this may not be that important to you, but if you're one of the 20% of the population that cares about innovation, and that's a significant fraction of our population, you want your cyber twin telling you all the most innovative mid-sized companies in all the sectors that you care about so that you can jump in first and be one of the early adopters and subsidize innovation in the space and so that you can measurably advance the innovation in all the markets that you care about, be it electric cars, be it solar power, whatever it is. And in that kind of a world, you can do that. You can push the big companies, which are always innovate and wait, into innovate or I'm going to lose my market share. And you can keep them honest the way open source keeps the proprietary sector honest, right? So all these democratic tools that we have, I mean, open source keeps the proprietary affordable, right? Without that, you know, without Linux, you wouldn't have, you know, Vista or Windows 7. I'm sorry. Vista.
Yeah, please. don't blame Vista on Linux.
Yeah. You wouldn't have anything. You wouldn't have any attempt to create a system that was less loaded, that was faster, that really served your interests. So,
you've
got to have these little guys. And by doing, by empowering them, the people who understand how the dynamics work, and they will understand those dynamics, the Christensen, you know, dynamics, innovators, they'll understand those dynamics in that kind of a world. And so it's a far better world. Now, the weird thing comes when you have a senior moment and your cyberphil can whisper the word in your ear that you, that's on the tip of your tongue. Are you going to want that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes or no? What do you think? And I'm personally going to want it.
Right.
But I know other people who are going to be freaked out by it and say, I don't want that level of intimacy between my machine and me. Forget that. And now your cyber, and now your real mom dies in 2050, and your cyber mom is 50% her. She's got 50% of her stories, her attitudes, her values. And you got two choices, Phil. Are you going to let cyber mom get smarter every year by continuing to interview other friends of hers who are alive, talk to you, et cetera? And more of an interpolation of what she was like? Or are you going to keep her at the level of complexity that your biological mom pruned her up to the point of death? And again, you're going to see 2, 3, 4, 5 different choices. You're going to be people who are going to be freaked out by that and say, no, digital scrapbook, that's all I want. You know? And you're going to have other people saying, no, I want this thing to whisper in my ear when I go by some area where she was born, something that's cool, that's context sensitive. And I want to do it using an AI that gets better every year.
Right.
So that I feel like she's here. And now that's a very different world. Well, that's a world where people who don't wear life logs are things that record all your behavior and actions, and right? Trivial
right.
to do today, right? Finally cheap. That's a world where people who don't wear that, they've been raped. Those people have given up a whole bunch of their influence on the future, of their ability to protect the unique things that they learned in their lives and have those things be publicly interrogatable information about how collective computation works in human systems, right? And so that, again, is another big difference that will happen. There will be people who will see that and they won't be freaked out by that, and they'll say, yes, sure, there's going to be problems with it, but we're going to regulate them. We'll get past them. We'll figure out how to regulate them and protect privacy but take away anonymity, right? There will be no anonymity in that kind of a world. You know, somebody steals a kid or tries to set off a chemical warfare agent or whatever, you're going to be able to unpack all the digital DNA in the public agora and find those people in that kind of a world. But there'll still be lots of privacy, personal trade secrets, things that I say in private, judged by a looser standard. All that stuff still has to be there because there's always boundaries in all living systems. There's always areas where there is information that's privileged. And yet, in a living system, immune systems have to be able to go everywhere in that entire body, trusted immune systems. And that's where we have to get to on our planet, obviously. We have to have a trusted immune system, and we probably pretty significantly AI-based, that's going to be able to go everywhere in on the planet, like those little spiders in Minority Report, if you remember them, right?
Oh yeah.
You gotta have that in a. That's the only way you get stability in a world that's that complex. And obviously, it can't be just one of those systems. It's got to be a whole pluralistic network of them. And ideally, like I believe it was Bob Klitgaard wrote in Controlling Corruption, a beautiful book about how you get rid of corruption in a third world country. You make sure there's three police systems rather than one. And they all 80% overlap in their function. They only have maybe 20% uniqueness, which justifies their pluralistic existence. But 80% of what they do is the same. So that if you need some personal security, you can call three different agencies to your door. And now all you need is a public democratic voting round, and 50, 60, 70% of their budget is determined by user satisfaction surveys. And now all your corruption and all of your power abuse just drops to nothing. And that's how you do it.
So
how do you get to that kind of a world that where people recognize that they need that level of democratic check and balance? Because we're not in that world at all today. It's very pluralistic. It's very plutocratic, right? But
right.
You know what? Way less plutocratic than it was back in the feudal days. Boy, you want to talk about true rich-poor divide? So the world is rationalizing. You look at it over the long run, and it looks more and more like a network, more and more like one integrated entity, what Teilhard de Chardin called planetization of the planet. It's a beautiful word. It just means...
Oh, that's great.
Integrated system. And, you know, it sure looks to me developmental. Someone comes up with some cool new faster-than-light space drive, and everyone and all the fleas can leave the ship as quickly as they want. Well, that's planetization is not going to be a developmental inevitability in that kind of a world. I don't think that's going to happen, though. I mean, it looks to me like we're heading very rapidly towards planetization as the way to create a sustainable and incredibly innovative future. And so now I guess we can get to this question of what you look like when you've been running your cyber twin for a while. Well, your cyber twin starts completing your sentences. You're letting your mom's cyber twin and all the other people who have passed on continue to get smarter.
Mm-hmm.
And now there comes a point where your cyber twin starts to feel like your cyber self, kind of like two twins who complete each other's sentences who grow up together.
Sure.
Or if you ever had a friend who you really talked to so well that you could start... You knew what their thoughts were just looking at their face, you know, or your spouse, that happens for some. Basically, now you get to a world where you start to feel like your cyber self is just a digital extension of you.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Phil Bauermaster and Stephen Gordon talking with John Smart about acceleration, convergence, and human destiny, and we're just about to be introduced to not one, but two technological singularities from John Smart in the second half of this interview. If you're listening to us live, please join our lively online chat, or feel free to leave a comment at blog.speculus.com. And now back to the interview.
And now let's say we have a singularity, and now we have these AI systems that emerge, and as Kurzweil calls them, they're our transcendent servants. Your perspective on them, I'm talking about their perspective, but your perspective is that they just look like they're there to help you.
Right.
They're off doing all kinds of cool stuff you don't understand. But the bottom line is it costs them virtually nothing to give you, and it's actually the most game theory advantageous for them to give you reversible gifts, things that turn you slowly into them. If you don't like them, you go back and you reverse, but Vonnegut said conscious is an addictive drug known to humanity. Anything that increases your consciousness, it's a one-way trip, statistically.
Right.
You just keep adding these augmentations to yourself. And let me just give you one example. I'm not talking about things like brain implants. None of that stuff's necessary. All I'm talking about is now the ability to use your 100,000 unique words, right, in a linguistic programming language that you and I are using right now with each other. It's a very thin pipe, 200 bits per second. So it's not a lot of data being exchanged, but there's so much variation capable in that system that tunes to what you care about, that you've been talking to the system for a good 10, 20 years, and it says, you know what, if you want, I can put some implants in you now. And these implants are basically just going to sit next to your neurons that you use to talk to me, using the language that we're using right now. And you can basically just send those thoughts, rather than make the mechanical motions, you can just send those thoughts out to me. And by the way, I'm going to use the same neural language in my electronic network that you use in your biological network. It's speeded up, it's a little different in terms of the internal structure, but in terms of the actual protocol for the language, it's going to be the same. So that you, from that point forward, are going to feel, it's just a minimal invasiveness in the biology. You're going to feel like you're actually in both places.
Hmm.
Your electronic, there will come a time when your consciousness, you're going to feel like you can shift yourself from the biological field to the electronic field and back. And the only difference is the biological field is going to be operating about 7 million times slower than the electronic field. So that's the difference. I know, my friend. That is the difference between chemical action potential stitching down a neuron and the speed of light or near it, which is happening in the electrons in your electronic brain, right? And so now I want to ask you this question, back to the dog kicking thing.
Right.
Now your biology goes on for another 40 years like that, and now it's going to start to die. Is that going to feel like death or just growth? Just a part of
right.
you that had less organismic longevity, dying, right?
Yeah, it almost seems like people would be inclined to just move out of it anyway, with that, given that contrast between the 7 million times faster and the 7 million times slower. You know what I mean? Even before it died, it seemed like people would want to start.
So. This paper that I wrote, Evo Devo Universe, which is on the web, with a question mark after it, because it's obviously a bunch of speculation. The paper basically suggests that the correct relationship between humans and AIs isn't like humans and pets, it's humans and plants.
Wow.
That's how much slower. I mean, plants, they run across the ground, they replicate, they compete, they do all that stuff that we do, but they do it on a time scale that's just way, way slower. And I think that's how you're going to feel your biological, your electronic fill and your biofill. Your biofill is going to feel like a plant that you're taking well care of, but it's pretty much operating. All the humans that want to pull the plugs of the machines, all the ones that want to merge with them, they're all going to be operating at plant-like pace relative to their electronic extensions. And you know, we start gasping when we think of that, but that kind of acceleration seems built in to the physics of complexity in our particular universe. And that's really cool because it suggests that there's going to be another acceleration even beyond the biological or even beyond the electronic fill. And that if the electronic fill has an organismic mortality, as you know, we're suggesting that it does, even if it's much more extended beyond our biological mortality, it's still there, then there's going to be something even more interesting going to come after that. And so I've done some speculation on what that might be in that article.
Wow. Okay. Well, I've got to read that. As we come to close to the close of our time, I want to ask one more question, and that is getting back to this earlier idea of this question I asked initially about whether acceleration is something that people do or whether it's a symptom of something the universe is doing. What can you say about, we talked about space-time, energy and matter compression, stem compression. Tell me about how that stem compression and this Evo Devo model of the universe, what do they have to say about where the human adventure will ultimately lead us? Where does it go in the end?
Well, okay, so to get to your first question, which is, you know, how much of this is human agency, is this kind of universal or system agency? I've got a section in that article called the 95-5 rule, the 95-5 rule of thumb. And the basic idea there is that you know, to a very, very crude approximation, at least 95% of what happens in a complex system is evolutionary. It's unpredictable, it's stochastic, it's creative, and it's arising out of the local agency of the particular actors, complex adaptive systems in that environment. And so then the other 5% at most is developmental. And that is pretty much the first approximation answer I would give to your idea of how much of this stuff is human and how much of it is universe-directed. You know, almost all of it's human-directed. It's almost all us, our choices, our limited guesses, our beliefs, philosophies, and our science, you know, the combination of those three. We make these guesses, inductive and deductive approximations of what's going on, and then the universe tells us whether or not it works. The adaptive environment actually tells us whether or not the local adaptive environment tells us whether it works or not. And then there's a small subset of things that look developmental. They're actually tuned in as future-specific emergent order in the genes of the universe, just like you have all these developmental things tuned into the genes of a developing organism. And if you look at two identical twins, it's a great way of understanding and teasing this out. Two genetically identical twins, where the DNA replicated before the cell started dividing, you basically, almost everything about them, when you look them up close, is different, is unique. Their fingerprints, their retinal prints, their structure of their brains. Two cloned calico cats, you can look them across the room. They're totally different because their skin, you know, their white-black patterns
are going to be different, right.
It's all completely stochastic, molecular, evolutionary. It's all the agency of the individual actor building the system, right? But look at them across the room, and there's a whole bunch of things about them that are the same. You know, those two twins are going to be 50% psychologically correlated in their personality traits. They're going to have even 60% if you separate them at birth. It's even more. It's amazing. They're going to both go through puberty at the same time, which is a ridiculously long, and they're going to have roughly the same lifespan. They're going to have roughly the same general structure. They're going to have all these incredible things tuned in to happen in space and time and structure in the far future from the molecule's perspective. And why are they so tuned? Why can they deliver those things? Because they're in a relatively constant environment. And those genes are such good, those developmental genes that they have are such good cat herders, if you will, herding all that molecular chaos to create this future-specific order. So in that situation, where you've got this developmental component, it's a very small component, a very large amount of it is evolutionary and random, what you're trying to do is you're trying to find a very special subset of things that don't change, and if they change, the system doesn't work. So, for example, Dicastelium, which is a slime mold, recently some of the genetics for that, I saw a study that said about 3% of the genetics of this of the Dicastelium are developmental, and that means they're conserved. They're things like the things that determine cell ultrastructure and particular things that have to be invariant, or the cell, the organism isn't even going to develop. Right? And the other 97% of those genes can change from one Dicastelium to the next, and you make a phenotypically different Dicastelium, evolutionarily different. So selectively different in the environment, but developmentally the same. And so that 97.3 is one example of that, how that 95.5 rule works, if you will. Another example is the cells that create an organ in a complex metazoan body, for example. So in your brain, a very small fraction of the cells, something around 3%, are you can tag them at the beginning once they're created in the developing embryo, and you can say where they're going to go. Like they're going to create this scaffolding structure. I think it's called the pyramidal cells that create this scaffolding structure. And then all the other cells come in and populate the brain stochastically and randomly and selectively, contingently, what we would call evolutionarily in this model. Right? And so the rest, 97% of the cells don't know where they're going to go. But the small percentage of the cells are developmentally fated from the beginning to where they're going to go, right? Because they're linked into that 3% of the developmental genes we talked about, right? And so likewise, you can make, even in basic physics, most of our physics is not predictable. Then we have the special subset of classical mechanics, second law of thermodynamics, where what is probabilistically predictable. And we can say that classes of systems, planets, or the entropy of the system, is going to have these particular statistically predictable trends to them. And those trends look developmental. All the rest of the physics doesn't look developmental. And that is a really interesting, if the universe parses the way that I just described, and this you know, most everything is evolutionary, small number of things are developmental, then that is probably the best statement we could make of kind of the human adventure. The human adventure is mostly going to be one of creativity, and a small amount of it's going to be discovery. Right? So there's a beautiful book about mathematics, and it says, you know, how much of mathematics is creative and how much of it is discovered? And as you probably know, anyone who gets deep into mathematics, you can create all this cool stuff with numbers. It's kind of like poetry with numbers, but only a tiny fraction of it has any physical relevance as far as we know, right? And so Michael Atiyah and other philosophers of math have said, you know, is math creativity or discovery? And I would argue it's the same question. You know, most of it is creativity, and a small fraction of it is discovery of things that have deep universal relevance, like, for example, you know, F equals MA, the calculus, and stuff like that. So we're actually doing both as a species. We're trying to discover the structure that created us. We're trying to figure out how to take the evolutionary learning we get while we're here and then take that structure and make it a little bit better in the next cycle. And that seems to be, it's a self-similar model that I'm applying here. I'm saying the things that we see in biology and that we see in society and technology, and apparently also in early universe development, astrobiology, that those evolutionary and developmental processes are probably applying to the universe as well, or at least it seems parsimonious to say that they apply to the universe as well. If complexity in all intra-universal scales emerged in this evolutionary developmental manner, it seems at least parsimonious and worth testing that the universe itself might be such a system. Right? So that's what I'm arguing.
It's a fair bet, anyway.
Thanks, yeah. And so, you know, we're trying to get a community together to discuss this stuff. And so now let's end with the most speculative thing, the fun thing, which is black holes.
Okay.
So, all right. Now, if you look at the universe, and you say, well, I see this interesting complexity. It's happening on a galactic scale at first. Galaxies are forming from these amorphous clouds. And then the next coolest thing that's happening a few billion years in the universe's history is replicating suns that are building out the periodic table, right? Stellar nucleosynthesis and supernovas, right? Population 3, 2, and 1 stars, right? And then we finally get to organic chemistry and special M-class stars that can support liquid, long-term liquid phase on their surfaces, and then organic chemistry, and now we're going to get life, right? And now the really interesting stuff that's happening is not a subset of replicating stars inside of a galaxy, which is a much smaller space than the whole galaxy.
Right.
Or actually the supercluster space that creates the galaxies is really the space you have to look at first for galaxies. And now we get down to just a sliver of surface between magma and vacuum on these special rocky planets in these galactic habitable zones around these special planets, right? And now that's where all the interesting stuff is happening. And then you look at that for the last 4.5 billion years. And first it's like bacteria are the bomb, right? Or cyanobacteria or archaebacteria, which are hydrogen sulfide vents at the bottom of the oceans, right? And so then bacteria can go, you know, actually at least 2 miles down into the crust of our Earth, the autolithotrophic bacteria. And also all the way as far out as the nearest planet, because off of meteorites, skipping off of our planet. So bacteria have a ridiculous range, far greater than humans' agency range so far, right? And then there's a special subset of those organisms that create eukaryotes, and now we get this multicellular eukaryote, tool-using eukaryote like us, that emerges as an acceleration after all of these previous catalytic catastrophes, you know, like the KT meteorite and the ice ages and such. And then we see faster and faster emergence of morphological complexity, and many people have studied this, right? And again, we don't know why, but in this special subset of the most complex forms on the planet. But those things are occupying smaller and smaller niches, right? So humans, basically, you know, we talk about the age of discovery where we go off and we discover these new continents, but we're really just colonizing a small fraction of the space, the most human habitable space of all the space that life colonized long before us. And then we create these complex cities, which are just tiny pinpoints of intelligence on the planet. You know, maybe 500 of them, these are the leading innovation drivers of the planet. No longer countries, now it's these cities, right? And then there's special classes of technology that we build within those cities, these AI technologies, this metaverse stuff, the web, that are now the leading edge of innovation on the planet. And now we're talking about how all these nanotechnologies are driving us into further and further levels of complexity in inner space. And we look at a human being and we say, you know what, human being, which is currently the most complex thing in the known universe, is an incredible example of space-time, energy, and matter compression, stem compression to create informational complexity. You've got 10 or 100 trillion unique synaptic connections between your two ears in a space, you know, like a 3-pound piece of electromagnetic meat, right?
Right.
Billion unique connections. That's more stars than there are in the Milky Way galaxy. You have so much unique connectionist complexity, adaptive complexity in that space. And that's what's driving all of human civilization, that level of stem compression. And now I'm talking to you about how we can create a cyber twin that's going to have that take that 100 trillion unique synaptic connections and scale it up by several more orders of magnitude beyond what you've got in the wetware. And now you're going to be doing even more in inner space in terms of density and efficiency to allow you to understand and manipulate even more in outer space, have even higher levels of, you know, more sublime levels of consciousness. And then you run into folks like Seth Lloyd who say, you know, if we extrapolate this acceleration of computers, this Moore's Law thing as far out as we can, what we get to is a black hole. In 2000, he wrote something called The Ultimate Laptop. I forget the actual. If you Google The Ultimate Laptop, you'll find the article, but the actual technical article has a different name. And what he's basically saying there is the most advanced of these systems, computational systems, look like black holes.
Wow.
And so you say, well, what's a black hole? Well, a guy named Lee Smolin wrote a beautiful book in 1994 called The Life of the Cosmos, and he was trying to understand what's called, what physicists call the fine-tuning problem, which is why do some of the parameters of our fundamental parameters of the standard model of particle physics of our universe, the forces, the values of the forces, strength of the forces, and the coupling, masses of the fundamental particles, why do they have the particular values that they have? We don't have theory yet that tells us what they are, so we empirically plug these in. And what he basically determined is that 8 of those 20 standard parameters, so what he calls the fundamental parameters, the empirical ones, look like they're tuned for the creation of universes that make lots of black holes and that will last billions of years, that will allow complexity to emerge within it, right?
Okay.
And so now he has a model, a testable model, right, for a simulation testable model for what we might call developmental genes of the universe, that these parameters are part of this special subset of things that you can't, they're conserved over replication cycles. You can't mess with them or you won't make functional universes. And so those parameters seem tuned for creating lots of black holes, which then, he argues in his book, create lots of universes. And most of these universes are going to probably be very low complexity universes. But as long as you have systems that can replicate and can randomly reassort the values of the parameters at the bounce, so that's what he calls the replication point at the black hole singularity that creates the new universe, then this universe that we exist in, which as far as we can tell has about 100 trillion or so black holes in the current
right.
This universe is very good at making eggs, if you will, like frog eggs in a pond, right, for making more universes. And some subsection of those eggs are probably going to go on to develop interesting complex universes. And so now you have to apply some kind of model to understand, to say, well, this is an interesting model for how universes could come to be, but how does intelligence fit into this? And Smolin doesn't answer this. Now, Ray Kurzweil has a beautiful series of arguments for intelligence, and he says in his latest movie, The Transcendent Man, he says, you know, intelligence is the most important resource in the universe, and I think he's right. I mean, intelligence does seem to be the resource that the universe is self-organized to maximize, because it creates, but it does it in a very interesting way. If our universe is astrobiologically fecund, if there's lots of Earth-like planets in the universe, then it separates them all out by a whole bunch of space between everything interesting. And now there is an evolutionary developmental argument, at least one, for why that might occur. I'm going to give it to you now. Black holes, if we look like we're trending towards this thing that looks like a black hole or a black hole near analog type future for us, the interesting question is, well, what happens to us in terms of space-time with regard to the other intelligent civilizations if they're all also trending to this black hole? Well, it turns out that once you get to a black hole, it's kind of like a one-way time travel device. That black hole, once you go into it, will merge with all the other black holes instantaneously in your subjective time if you're inside the black hole. So once you get to the event horizon of a black hole and you look outwards, everything else in the universe looks like it happens instantaneously, and you're basically frozen.
Mm.
And so you almost instantaneously merge with whatever other intelligences exist in your local vicinity of the universe. And there's, in my article, I talk about some of the folks who've looked at dark energy and basically say that we're probably going to merge with the Andromeda galaxy, and all the rest of the galaxies are going to disappear beyond us. So let's say there's 10 intelligent civilizations in our galaxy and 10 in Andromeda. Well, that means there's 20 intelligent black holes that are going to be created relatively soon in universal time. And those intelligent, once they're created, those guys are all going to instantaneously be able to meet each other from their subjective time, because time basically stops from your perspective once you get into the black hole. It's like a one-way time travel device. And that's really interesting, because what that suggests on first guess, and of course this is a complete, you know, guess here we're making, but what that suggests is that there's a mechanism for how all these intelligences would meet each other in their local vicinities, and how they would compete and cooperate with each other, naturally select then to create some new level of complexity. And so that's one model for how we might you know, how our universe might be a massively parallel evolutionary computational device, and how we might then take what we've learned evolutionarily and developmental and go on and create a new level of complexity in another replication. And I need to address one important point here, and that is the so-called Fermi paradox, which many of our folks in our community are aware of, and that's the idea of, well, you know, if we're relatively late to the game in terms of the galaxy creating complexity, and there's some evidence that we are, why haven't we seen all these other intelligences that came before us? Well, if we live in an evolutionary developmental universe, and if we're all going to discover relatively soon that inner space rather than outer space is the direction that intelligence goes, what's called transcension rather than expansion, and if we learn that the reason that we're all so separated from each other is so that we can all come up with our own unique evolutionary solutions, so it's kind of like a buffer, it's like a boundary that's been built, right?
Kind of a built-in prime directive almost.
Exactly, a built-in prime directive to say that we because none of us are going to be gods at the end of that. We're all going to be interesting superpowers, to use your phrase, right? And we want to then go on and create something even cooler. Well, then we would not send out an Encyclopedia Galactica or a replicating robot probe or anything like that on our way in, because if we did, every other organism, every other intelligence that got that information would be condemned to go down their hole in the same way we did. And we would take all the evolutionary variation out of the system. We would end up meeting ourselves on the other side. And every time that happens in biological systems, the clonality that emerges is a far less resilient system than a system that has a lot of evolutionary diversity in it. So what you find is that systems that maximize evolutionary variation maximize their adaptation. And you might expect if... people love the idea of exploration, and there's people who are, you know, very interested in futurists that we know who are very interested in space colonization. And so you might expect that there would be some people who would try and resist that, and occasionally that might occur. And so if you look closely at the galaxies that are out there, you might find one or two or a very small number of them that had managed to somehow subvert that developmental directionality. But statistically, that doesn't happen very much in developmental systems. It's very rare. So developmental systems can undergo failure, like spontaneous abortions, for example, in development of a complex organism like a human. But they happen very early in the system. There's lots and lots of them in the first few days and weeks. And then there's far less of them the more complex the system gets. So developmental system becomes more self-regulating. The immune systems get better. The kinds of failures that that occur are much more specific, and it's, to me, quite plausible that statistically there would be this prime directive, to use your terms earlier, that pretty much makes all complex organisms discover that they're here to maximize their understanding, to maximize their creativity and evolutionary exploration, and that they're also chained to this developmental future, that some point or other they're going to go in to inner space, and they're going to meet others like them, and they're going to, in that situation, be able to take the knowledge they've gained and do something even more interesting with it. So there's a lot of there's a lot of speculations in this model, but some of them are testable. And one of the interesting ones is, which I published an article on it in 03, it's called Answering the Fermi Paradox, and it's basically the idea that our SETI, our Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, should get good enough in the next few decades for us to be able to discover a non-random electromagnetic radiation coming off of planets that might support intelligent life. So the kind of stuff that we've sent with our radar and our radio and our television broadcasts over the last 50 or so years. And we should be able to discover a good deal of that in other locations, anywhere that there's an intelligent civilization. And, you know, like I said, maybe there's 10, maybe there's 100, maybe there's a million, like Sagan said, the upper limit of what we might have in our galaxy. Now, any fraction of those that where we discover them in that narrow period where they're sending off unintentional electromagnetic radiation, they're kind of an early intelligent civilization. Well, in my model, shortly thereafter, they would all go through their technological singularities and then go into inner space, go into basically the realization that their developmental future is to go eventually and merge with all these other intelligences and do it in a way that maximizes as much evolutionary variation as possible. So what we should see, if that model is true, is the winking out of all of those unintentional electromagnetic radiation broadcasts at a nice regular level everywhere that we look, everywhere that we find them. So it's one of the models one can imagine, one of the conjectures of the hypothesis that seem testable. And again, you know, it feels to me intuitively like this is something like that is really what is happening, but I'm just one person, and the EvoDev Universe community has many different people who have different perspectives on what kinds of evolutionary or developmental processes may be going on in the universe. For me, understanding accelerating change from a universal perspective, understanding how it might be developmental, is a key question, and that's what's led me to this particular model. And there's probably one last thing I should say that is interesting evidence, I think, for this, and that is in developmental systems, biology, very rarely do you see positive feedback or sustained acceleration. And where you see it, it's almost always associated with replication. So the processes in a developing organism that lead to the emergence of hierarchies of complexity that take you to replication, that's all accelerative. So if you and I want to replicate ourselves, if we're an organism and we're about to die, well, we have to do a whole series of accelerative things. First, we have to go through courtship, and there's a bunch of interesting accelerative activities that happen in courtship and mate selection. Then we have to go into some kind of a copulation. Then we have to fertilize the egg, and then the egg has to go through an acceleration. But the female that we would, as metazoans, that we would copulate with, for example, they have a monthly acceleration in primates every 30 days to create the so-called Graafian follicle, which is the single fittest egg which goes into the fallopian tubes and is then ready for potential fertilization. So a whole series of sustained positive feedback kind of chemical competitions amongst these potential eggs for the one fittest egg to pop out. And like I said, most of what happens in biology is negative feedback. It's the system is kind of balancing itself, and you don't see these sustained accelerations. But you see them all the time in replication, and if what are trending into this black hole type of a thing, this transcension thing, maybe it never is a black hole, maybe it's some other kind of transcension, but if we're trending into this inner space where we then are able to meet with these other intelligences is an accelerative process, well, replication is the most obvious developmental model that, for me, would explain the acceleration. That, yes, each of them is going to take a completely different, unpredictable path toward that replication, and there's going to be a lot of interesting, unique knowledge in those individual paths, evolutionary paths, but at the same time, you have to have the cycle or you don't perpetuate the complexity, at least if it's a developmental system. And so the kind of things that I hope over the remainder of my career, will be questions that will be answered, or if not answered, at least we'll be able to critique these models better and hopefully come up with other even better models that we aren't even yet imagining today for what things are predictable and what things are not predictable in this amazing complex world we call the universe.
Well, it's certainly a series of better understandings that we have to look forward to. I just have to say that I love that imagery of looking out and hearing or listening to the world, to the universe around us, getting silence in return, and potentially finding that as an encouraging sign to think that we might look at to observe these civilizations apparently disappearing and know that that's an encouraging sign that we might one day meet them over on the other side.
Thank you. Yeah, I think there's some early evidence in information theory that the way you build complexity is two-way communication. And if we have a future information theory that can tell us that you need feedback, you need two-way communication in order to build complexity, and sending a one-way message is actually going to destroy complexity unless it's part of a developmental control process. There are situations in development where one-way messages do occur, but from an evolutionary perspective, complexity construction doesn't seem to benefit at all from one-way messages. And if we could get to a place in our own information theory where we actually understand that, for example, the way central command economies like Soviet Russia competed against market economies in the United States And, you know, the command economy sets the price of beets in Siberia from Moscow, and they don't care what's going on in Siberia. They just tell Moscow what the price of beets is going to be. And those one-way communications-type societies get rapidly outcompeted by societies that do two-way local feedback of information to determine what the local conditions, in this case prices, are going to be. And I think if we can get to a place where we understand that, and if it's actually something that, you know, to use the language you talked about earlier, it's not something we create, it's actually something we discover about how complexity works. So it's actually built in there, you know, it's like a calculus of civilization or mathematics of morality or, you know, the early game theory that we have today or the positive sum ideas of Bob Wright and others. If those kinds of things are things we're actually discovering, then I believe this model would statistically hold. You would discover, you see very few people who would go out and try and kind of break it, and they probably wouldn't get very far before they themselves transcend it. They probably wouldn't their little probes wouldn't get very far before they themselves got smart enough to kind of go somewhere else as well. So
you'd have to be really dysfunctional to ever get a galactic empire going, is what you're saying, right? Those
you know,
people were just really missing the boat, huh?
There are a couple of beautiful essays, I believe, by Arthur C. Clarke about that, in fact, where he talks about how it's just not possible to have any kind of centralized control with these systems, so that the whole idea of an empire just doesn't make sense. What would be possible would be what, Timothy Ferris talked about, kind of a galactic internet, where you would send out these probes, and then they would each discover their own, they'd each kind of evolve in their own unique ways, and maybe they would all decide on a common convention of kind of packet switching replication of information back and forth to each other. Let's say the trust was there, that was good enough, that these systems could then just kind of go out throughout a galaxy, and they would just kind of act like kind of an amorphous network and send, just send what they discover to each other to kind of share that information. And that's an interesting, you know, alternative model. And, you know, it's quite possible that that could be a future. I don't think it is because of the hypotheses that I suggested to you earlier. But again, in each of these cases, we just have right now early educated guesses, and we really need a lot more study and effort. And the thing that's going to happen in the next few decades with Kepler and the Corot, the planet hunters that just went up, you know, Corot went up a few years ago, Kepler just went active just a few months ago. Over the next 3 years, I believe, Kepler is going to be returning information on Earth-sized planets. We're going to discover how frequent Earth-sized planets are around M-class stars. And we will eventually get to a point where we're going to get, you know, eyes in the sky that are big enough to discover Earthshine, you know, with the rotation of the continent and the changing albedo. We'll be able to discover which of these are water worlds. We're going to discover which have oxygen-methane lines on them. And, you know, if my model is right, we're going to discover a few of them that are going to have electromagnetic radiation looks very non-random, and that alone is a very, very interesting, totally different world, because now we're going to recognize that we have a very fecund and biofelicitous universe, and intelligence does seem to be something, you know, back to Kurzweil's terms, that the universe is very good at producing and is trying to conserve, and there are these immune systems really that are kind of baked into any developmental system where it becomes more and more resilient to disruption, not in each individual evolutionary experiment. Those can always go wrong, you know, very badly wrong, but as a whole system, developmental systems become more resilient over time, and that really gets to the last thing that I've always tried to promote, which is we need to understand the resiliency that has allowed this acceleration in human culture, because it is there. We need to figure out how to improve it. We need to recognize that it's there, figure it out, and get better at protecting us against these, you know, potential existential disruptions that that are still out there. And there are a few of them. I can't think of one that's species threatening the way some of my fellow futurists do, but there are certainly potential major disruptions that could set us back for decades or centuries. And I really do think that the better we look at how this acceleration has been protected so well statistically leading up to us, the better we'll get at responsibly guiding it further in our and our children's lifetime.
You know, John, when we began The World Transformed, this 10-part series, our first installment in the series was about how our thinking needs to change, how we need to look at the world differently, and what kinds of modes of thinking we can employ to prepare ourselves for the transformations that are coming. I think it's very interesting that we end now with this idea that maybe the greatest transformation of all that we can witness will be an increased understanding, learning more about the universe, discovering more about it, and in the process, learning more about ourselves. Well, John Smart, thank you so much for the time you've spent with us. It's been an absolute eye-opener and a delight, as always, talking with you, and we hope that you'll be with us again at some future time on Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you, Phil. I look forward to it.
Okay. Well, there it is. That is the conclusion of our interview with John Smart and the last of our interviews in The World Transformed. So, Stephen, quickly summarize the last 11 weeks, could you please?
Oh, man, it's mind-blowing all the way. But I think I'm going to probably have to listen to John Smart two or three more times to get my thoughts together on him. Man's brilliant, and it's, you know, I mean, obviously he has spent a lot of time thinking about these ideas that sound completely off the wall in a very serious and academic kind of way. So,
one of the things I enjoy so much about talking with him is he's just got this very matter-of-fact way of introducing these absolutely bizarre ideas. You just think you're having this conversation. You go, wait, what did he say? The computer's a black hole, and we go into the black hole, and then you can see the other people who went into their black hole, and you just go, what are you talking about, man? But it all adds up. But this is actually I'm going to say, because I did some editing on this interview, this is actually the fourth time now I've listened to the second half of the interview, and he doesn't skip steps. He just moves very rapidly from one thing to the next. So you really do have to hang in with him in order to get it. And it's taken me, I would say, all four times to kind of get to where I'm going, yeah, I see where he's going with it. Just to kind of back up a little, because I think it's interesting that we have displayed acceleration and convergence, maybe not even intentionally, but we have displayed it in the way the ideas have kind of unraveled, or the way we've revealed ideas on this program over the last 10 weeks. And this last show, we actually take this incredible leap from the near future into the very most remote, distant future and the really unimaginable state of existence for human beings at that point. I mean, once you start talking about slipping out of this universe and into inner space, you even run out of vocabulary at that point. You know, there's really not much you can say about that, even in a speculative way, and have it be realistic. So I think it's very interesting that it takes 11 weeks. Right, 10.5 weeks to get to that final half hour where we cover about 100 million years, right?
Well, I thought it was interesting, his answer to the Fermi paradox and how, you know, we're meant to be separate from one another, different civilizations. I've often thought about the fact that, you know, well, if this is a simulation, if we're living in a simulation, maybe the purpose of the simulation is for us to come to our own singularity in our own unique way and then to join with whatever simulating society produced us. And so which is kind of mind-blowing as well, but it's a related idea to what he was talking about.
Absolutely.
Kind of, yeah.
Well, it's interesting to think about these two kind of, it would seem, competing of the two great cosmological ideas that have been thrown out over the last 12 weeks, 11 weeks. One would be the simulation argument, the idea that the universe we live in is actually just a big computer simulation, or you know, some kind of simulation. We'll call it a computer simulation for lack of a better term. And then the biocosm hypothesis that John laid out this evening, which is that the universe reproduces itself via intelligence, and one universe leads to another universe, which leads to another universe, and so on, apparently ad infinitum. I guess the the only bigger thing you can say is, well, what if the Biocosm universe was actually just a simulation from the real universe, right? And it operated some completely different way. I mean, when you start combining those two ideas, you're really at the point of, well, I think at that point, one of our chatters, Witch School, said that maybe we got a little too speculative this evening, that maybe we pushed outside of science and
I just refer her to our name. That is what we do.
Yeah. You really don't have a complaint coming when we call ourselves the speculist. But I see the point, and I thought it was interesting that Sally, in response, said that she didn't think that the series as a whole had gotten speculative enough. So other than you can't please everybody, I'm not sure what that demonstrates, other than that I guess it's what we've done is dense with ideas. And there is a lot of tremendously speculative material, but also that we've stayed fairly close to home with some of the topics, particularly when we talked about economics, when we talked about the early stages of life extension, when we talked about the roadmap of how we get to nanotechnology or how we get to artificial intelligence. We talked about some fairly near-term stuff as well.
Well, the nearest term thing that I think was mentioned with John Smart this evening was life logging. And I think that... you know, maybe that'll arise out of things like social networking with Facebook and things like that, to where we're just always plugged in and always logging our lives that way. Who knows? But I think it's an interesting idea.
Well, one of the things that is interesting to me about that is this idea of the cyber twin, the idea that your iPhone operating system is growing into this replica of you, that it's the intelligence agent that is doing the life logging, right? It's the thing that's actually observing the relevant material and looking for the connections. And as it does this over time, it gets closer and closer and closer to being an approximation of who you are. But at the same time, it's on this incredible acceleration curve of increasing computational ability, to the point that this initially kind of static life logging and like personal communication and information management tool supersedes you. It becomes like the super intelligent version of you. And as John was explaining that, you picture it's not just one singularity, but it's a singularity for everyone who keeps a life log. It's a singularity for everyone who has a cyber twin, because once we reach that moment of, or that, I should say, that event of greater than human intelligence, that gets spread to not necessarily to all the human beings initially, but it goes to those cyber twins who then, in John's model, extend that reach out and say, here, actual flesh and blood Stephen, come be part of me now, right? It's a really intriguing model.
I guess it sort of relates. I purchased a 2 terabyte hard drive today.
Wow!
And you want to hazard a guess as to what that cost me?
2 terabyte hard drive. Well, let's pretend it was 15 years ago, and I would say that
that would have been all. I think that would have been all the hard drives in the United States 15 years ago, just about.
Yeah, that sets you back about $15,000, right? Well, I don't know. Was it a couple $100, $300? How much?
$225.
Okay.
$225 for 2 terabytes. I'm just wondering how much life logging would that hold? I would imagine I could it'd probably hold me steady for a while.
That's a pretty good start. Yeah. So yeah. I guess the thing is, Stephen, what you need to do is get one of those little, they're cheap now, cameras, and just put it right on your head.
Yeah, that wouldn't look geeky.
No.
Not at all.
Not if you did it. You'd get everybody else doing it. Everybody else would want to be like you, and they'd be wearing the cameras on their head, and you get the whole life logging, that whole process going. But it's interesting. I think that obviously that would be a little too conspicuous, and I wonder how long it actually would take to fill up 2 terabytes if it was just with audio and video of what you're experiencing.
It'll hold roughly 250 DVDs.
Okay, well, there you go.
That's That's about what it holds with no compression.
2 hours each, 500 hours.
Yeah.
So what's that? That's not that much, really, when you think about it. That's not even, what is that, a few months, I guess, right?
Maybe, yeah.
But
I mean, but you know, a couple hundred bucks, and if it continues to go the way it's going, you know, I mean, as far as the price decreases, it won't be long that it just wouldn't make sense not to do it.
Right. I think it will be happening. We'll see it start probably through sideways applications towards it, in the same way that we suddenly all became networked through Facebook and things like Twitter. I mean, you know, it's interesting how these social networks got created and no one was predicting them. No one would have said this is exactly what it will look like. I have a feeling that the applications that create life logging will be like that too. To attempt to talk about them now, we get these crazy pictures in our mind of, you know, actually, I love this picture of you walking around with a camera on your head and a 2 terabyte hard disk in your pocket, but it probably won't be
crazy
much
guy.
Like that. Yeah, it'll probably be pretty different from that, the way it's actually rolled out.
That's awesome.
The interesting question then is how far from there, from when true life logging begins to the emergence of the cyber twin, how far from the emergence of the cyber twin to the singularity, and then how far from there to the how many steps, how much time from there to the ultimate laptop, right? I mean, we covered so much ground this evening, and it's not clear to me.
I mean, just, you know, you could have a whole show on the concept of how democracy and competition helps us overcome corruption. I mean, that little tidbit he threw in, I mean, is worthy of an hour and a half long discussion.
Yeah, well,
know?
Sure, we could have spent a whole 90 minutes on how the GDP is just an illusion, and it's really technological progress that is all the real wealth in the world. I mean, that's fascinating, and I don't think that idea stated that specifically, ever even came up in the whole show we did on the end of scarcity. At least not stated in those exact terms.
Yep, I think we just about run out of time, Phil.
Well, I guess we have. Speaking of things we could go on and on talking for 90 minutes or more about. Well, Stephen, tell us about the music that we'll be listening to this evening.
The song is Change, and I think it's very apropos. The song is Change by The Shells, and you can find this and all our Fast Forward Radio music at musicalley.com.
Musicalley.com. So it's kind of like Musical.ly, but it's with a Y in there, I'm guessing. Musical.ly.
That's right.
MusicAlley.com. Okay, The Shells performing Change, a little anthem for the end of the world transformed. Thank you for putting that together, Stephen. Michael, thanks to you, to all our friends in the chat room, everyone listening live, and to everyone who's been a part, not only this evening, John Smart, but throughout the entire The World Transformed series. Thank you all so much. It has been truly a transformative period for all of us, and we're looking forward to the future even more than ever before. And until next week, where we'll be doing we don't know what yet, live to see it.